Welcome to episode 156 of the Omni Gamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including trying to Tetris all of your guns and herbs into your suitcase. I am Daniel Winter.
And I'm Mark USA. And we are fortunate enough to be joined by a special guest whose name is Phil Gross. Welcome, Phil. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. This is a real treat. I've enjoyed your show, and it's a pleasure to be on.
Excellent. Yeah, thank you for. I mean, I guess I should point out one brief conflict of interest is I think you commissioned my wife for a piece of artwork, not like related to a game, but not in a game at least. So I don't know if that counts. But many people would know you, Phil, as a game designer. It's based in New York, I believe, is it? Or thereabouts?
That's right. Syracuse, New York.
Excellent. And I know there's a big, huge games design community over there. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit more about some of the work you've done.
Thank you. So I've had a couple party games published. Contrabanter and Normal Human with Skybound and R&R Games. And right now, my game, The Monolith, is up on Kickstarter for Plaid Hat Games. I design all over the map. I enjoy story games. I enjoy trick-taking. I'm working on a negotiation game. All sorts of different things. I truly am an omni-gamer. And so I feel right at home with you too.
Excellent. Very cool. Well, I mean, speaking of which, we'd like to ask all of our guests, what kind of omni gamer are you? I mean, in terms of what you play, that is, well, people would know you from the board game scene, but do you play any video games, TTRPGs? No right or wrong answer. Just curious, what's your background?
Maybe.
Well, not far from LARPs. My play preference for role playing is story games. The simplest example would be Jason Morningstar's Fiasco. I have a long background in long-form improv, and so story games are kind of like doing improv with training wheels on. So that's a nice, approachable way to get my friends around the table telling exciting and humorous stories together. I also enjoy video games quite a lot. I don't play them as much as I used to. Lately, I've snuck in some game time late at night with some Resident Evils, which I think we'll be talking about later. And I also enjoy playing with my son. He's 6. We play right before he gets on the bus. So I'm finding family friendly things to play with my boy in the morning. And then at night I do what dad wants to do, I guess. But I've been a Nintendo fanboy for pretty much all my life, with a brief excursion in the Xbox 360. And so I'm very happy with the Switch systems. And so I'm on Switch 2 now.
Yeah, I think we've both largely pivoted from Xbox 2 to Switch 2 for various reasons. Not least of which my daughter, of a similar age and playing a lot of games together there. And like speaking of storytelling games, like I've always struggled with storytelling games, but she loves that. So it's almost like training wheels as well, sort of playing with your kid. Slightly lower expectations from without all the anxieties of playing with strangers, I guess.
That's awesome. All right. Well, we're definitely going to be talking about, I think you have a game on Kickstarter. Phil, do you want to tell us about the game that you are most actively promoting at the moment?
Sure. So this is The Monolith, and it's a dark sci-fi game. Humanity has landed on an alien planet and become enthralled by this terrible tower that demands bloodshed in exchange for great power. And so it's a sort of troops on the map game, kind of like Kemet, if you know more recent ones, or Risk, if you don't. And it's very strategic. The game is kind of closer to what I would call an OG Euro for the real board game nerds here. There's no breaks for dice in combat, for example. Everything is handled by the actions. And the way it works is you've got a supply of hearts, human hearts, that you're managing to pay off your regular actions, like marching around the map. And after that phase, whatever hearts you withhold are going to be dropped into the tower. And the tower is going to divvy up those hearts into the actions for combat. And there's some ways to mitigate that and plan around it. But it's a very in-your-face, sort of brutal game. It's a, from my end, it's a satire of the sort of endless wars that are contemporary to us, to religious violence when people are beholden to a power that they believe is speaking to them and telling them that they've got all the right answers. And it's a hoot. It's been a real pleasure to work on for 3.5 years. So the game was always intended for Plaid Hat from the very start. I've been very happy to work with them. I've been a fan of theirs for a long time. And the work they've done for the development and setting the world in this dark universe is just a real trip. And they've got three wonderful artists on the project: Thomas Elliott, Alfie Garland, and Calder Moore. And these guys have really stepped it up a notch. The cards in the game, I remain impressed that they each one tells its own vibrant story of the action, and the characters are grotesque and disturbing.
Extremely heavy metal.
It is, yeah, and that's exactly what Colby Dauch, the lead of Plaid Hat, said when I pitched him. Originally, I pitched the game as to be set in Summoner Wars, which is their flagship title, because we had talked 10 years ago about his desire to have a Troops on a Map game in Summoner Wars. And after I showed him the game, he paused for a minute and he said, "This could be so metal." And here we are.
Nothing more metal than a giant pillar in the middle of the table. I mean, we've seen Dark Tower as well, dropping skulls into it as well, and human hearts here. I mean, bringing your own human hearts, I guess, not get human hearts not provided. But yeah, reading through your design notes, I was quite curious hearing about you had a previous iteration of this called Dropships, I think it was called, where you're like dropping, like sort of deploying dice and sort of spitting them out in sort of random directions, almost like the space fighter pilot shooting out of a mothership or something. Incredibly evocative, the towers and dropping things into it and the way they reveal and deflect, and it's a really cool physicality in board games in that sense.
Thanks. Yeah, that was the very first germs of the idea of using a tower. And that game was my attempt to do Star Fox, speaking of video games. So you would shoot the dice and they became power-ups that you allocated to your ship blueprint. And it had some neat systems in it, but as it turns out, it's really hard to generate tension from a system that has that much spatial randomness. So the tower in Monolith is a complete inversion of that tower. It keeps the pieces inside it. It sorts them and it holds them off for a big reveal. So I love the drama, like between phases, everyone's slowly dropping their hearts into the tower. And you're wondering where they landed and what everyone's power potential is going to be going into combat. And then finally, all at once, you lift the tower off its base and have this big dramatic reveal. It's a great moment.
Yeah, speaking of tension, there is an incredible amount of power in the reveal as a sort of almost ritualistic moment, the build up and release as all this information is released at once and you're trying to interpret that suddenly. And it's a bit of a randomizer as well, I guess, having to improvise with that. What I was curious about is I've often struggled with these sort of dudes on a map game and or just direct aggression in games, and especially Mark and I would play sort of a lot of 4X adjacent style games. Often where aggression is one of multiple paths, and then you can really feel, I mean, at least I do, can feel sort of mean when you sort of attack someone else, and it can feel a little arbitrary. But when games like this where there's no other option, like it's get into a brawl or fall behind, like it's much more easier to have that excuse to duke it out, I guess. And so you've got a lot of motivations here, encouraging people forcing them into this direct conflict, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. I agree with you. The design intent is to create that magic circle where when everyone is given permission to be aggressive, it feels like it's a comfort level. It's a consent that we've all agreed to. Right. And so we know that the game is going to be over in 2 hours. And along the way, we're going to laugh about, Nate knocking over my guys and killing them all.
My feelings.
Right? Which actually does literally happen in the game. When you kill a unit, you knock it over, just like when we were kids playing Army Men. And so, that's something that I wanted to explore in this in particular, was that evocation of violence in a safe space. Right, I feel like games are particularly well suited to explore darker themes like that in a way that an audience that has consented to play the thing together is going to be able to explore it in perhaps new ways. Sideways inspiration I remember now is Jason Matthews commented, is the designer of famous games like Twilight Struggle, which is a war game about the Cold War, with his co-designer, and that was Ananda Gupta. And Jason, on a thread on Board Game Geek on Hansa Teutonica, which is a brown Euro game about
age as it gets.
Yeah, it's about pushing beer around Germany with cubes and discs. And he said, Hansa Teutonica has more aggressive conflict in it than many war games do.
Although I do think Hansa Teutonica is more about passive aggressiveness than direct aggression.
Yeah.
They're standing in each other's way, but largely. But I did want to bring up that comparison because that's one of my favorites. I know Mark isn't quite as much of a fan.
No, but I think you're right. I think that the theme, you know, you said that it's very heavy metal inspired. I think that gives the players an indication of what they're stepping into. You know,
it's expectations.
It's going to have that little, you know, pushing the envelope, get a little bit aggressive. And I think, yeah, you're right. Most players for a couple of hours can probably try out something that they're not so comfortable with if they're not, you know, conflict averse.
In my point of comparison would be something like Blood Rage is one I've played a lot of. And again, it's there's really no excuse but to run directly at each other, like you know, in Lord of the Rings or something. There's no answer but conflict in these games.
There's only war.
Yeah, I mean, Blood Rage is a point of reference. Kemet, you say there's only war, and a big inspiration was Warhammer 40K. Which I played quite a bit back in, you know, high school. And yeah, so all of these different games have drank from this similar well.
One final thing I want to pick your brain on, I noted in your design diaries, and I'll put the link for these in the show notes, is you pointed out you originally had a lot more asymmetry in this game. And I think that has become a bit of a crutch in some games in terms of trying to draw out replayability. Even Summoner Wars, for example, has a lot of different factions and each faction having different abilities. But there is a real elegance to sort of trying to balance readability with that replayability, I guess. Like I've been playing a lot of Toy Battle with my daughter, which just has, you know, I think seven types of units, but each side is going to have those same units. So you know exactly what each side is capable of, and it's easy to tell what the board state is rather than trying to, you know, interpret and read upside down on the other side of the board what everyone is capable of. And so I think you'd reduce that down in this game to just like each faction having one unique ability that sort of defines them, so you can read that board state more easily.
Yes, that's right. I love Toy Battle, by the way. That was my favorite game of last year. Just sublimely approachable and real good crunchy decisions. I had started with powers that you unlocked as you played, and there was never, like in Root, there wasn't, by Cole Worley, there was never a truly asymmetric play. Everyone had the same rules that they were following for how they
same verbs.
For how they used the pieces. But that's right, that the amount of asymmetric power did get focused. And that was one thing, you know, in the first time I had pitched Colby, he said, you know, this game has a bit of bloat to it. It looks like, you know, you've been working on it for a while and you kind of let it get past you a bit. Can you cut? And so that was one of the first easy things to cut back on, was to divvy up the best powers from those factions and really focus them. And it still took more development work to get them to where they are now. I'm really proud with how precise how they feel like signature moves for each ability. So you have a shaman leader, and the leader has an ability, and it's that simple. Yep.
Excellent. Well, the Monolith is on Kickstarter through to September 17th, I think. We'll put the link in the show notes if you're interested in looking more into that. I know it has fulfilled its goal at this point, but the more the merrier, as it were, in board games. So, yeah, looking forward to seeing how that plays out and then trying it ourselves one day.
Cheers. Thank you so much.
Awesome. What do you think, folks? Should we talk about some newer topics? What's been going on in the game space?
Yeah, not a lot of news this week. I mean, the one thing I was going to bring up is that PAX Unplugged, which I've attended, and I'm guessing you likely have, Phil, being over in your neck of the woods, but they just announced a new location in Houston. I believe PAX South was originally somewhere in Texas, and there was some change I'm not familiar with, but it's moved cities and is now being officially sort of rebranded as another PAX Unplugged. I mean, on one hand, it's great to see another opportunity, another outlet for board games. It's obviously the industry showing a lot of growth and opportunities there. It's not the location I would have loved to see those opportunities grow in, unfortunately. I mean, we're avoiding the states altogether, but Texas is a particularly sensitive spot for various social issues right now, shall we say. And there's already a bunch of, I think Board Game Geek Con is down that way, and at least one Dice Tower convention. So it's already pretty overserved, I think.
Yeah, it's a very interesting dilemma. Personally, I feel like there's already enough of these conventions, but it's helpful you point out that there's so many in that region already, because that would be a good reason to have one, at least regionally, but there are several. I understand that the video game side of the conventions may not be as doing as well as because of, as you guys have talked about many times, the changes to the landscape of AAA and other parts of that industry. And so they did pivot to another unplugged tabletop focused convention. I already know of some of my designer friends who will not be attending because it's in Texas. I have friends who live in Texas now and have in the past. And I like to believe I've only been to San Antonio once, but I like to believe that it's safe enough to travel to one of the cities for a brief time, but I wouldn't want to, impose that risk or question on anyone who feels it's a risk. My friends at DVC Games who are local are not planning to go, and that's a queer-owned company. And so, I sympathize with them. And as for myself, I've got plenty of conventions to go to already, and it's burning a hole in my pocket.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up the video game comparison there, because I mean, broadly, I would have thought the video game industry is still so much larger and more diverse that you could have so many different PAX conventions across the country, across the world, and have completely unique games at all of them. The board game industry still seems a little more localized. I mean, at least in the North America scene, where all of the big publishers are going to all of these conventions, right? It's a little harder for the smaller, there are a few indie markets popping up, but you can't really fill a PAX Unplugged with indie game markets.
yes, it's a bit of a shame. I mean, you watch E3 fall apart, right? And so I think they're getting their act together, and it would be nice if the act was not at the cost of all of these developers and other people working at the companies for their livelihoods. But that's what we're working through.
All right. My bit of video game news is pretty quick and cheerful. People know probably from listening that I'm a fan of retro RPGs, especially JRPGs. So I'm pleased to report that one game that really slipped my attention at the time is coming back to PC. And this is originally came out in 1995 for the Super Nintendo Entertainment System, a JRPG called Terranigma. Have either of you guys heard or played potentially this game?
I've heard of the name. I couldn't tell you much about it.
Yeah, I feel like if I saw the name, it was probably on an EMULATOR.
Yes, one of those, or maybe in the pages of EGM or something like that back in the day. Yeah, this game, I didn't have an opportunity to play it, but I think it's great for game preservation in any way that these games are coming back in a legitimate, legal way to play them. And thankfully, this game is on GOG as well as Steam, so DRM free. Go get it if you can. So we'll share the news story from Rock Paper Shotgun where I read this. Super NES JRPG Terra Enigma coming back after 31 years.
Wow.
Very cool.
What do you think, guys? Shall we talk about some meteor topics?
Yes, absolutely. I think we've all got a classic series that we all wanted to compare some thoughts on. So I think we'll jump over to the main course and get
Let's
started.
Let's do it. So I guess we're talking about a game, we're talking about a series, we're talking about other disparate entries into the series. I think we already teased it a little bit when you were talking about it, Phil. We're talking about kind of Resident Evil in general. Maybe we can just quickly compare notes about our personal history with Resident Evil. Like, where did we jump in, and maybe the breadth of titles we played. Phil, you want to fill us in on your Resident Evil experience?
I would love to, Mark. I have a couple of favorite memories. Like I said, I'm a Nintendo fanboy, so my introductions to Resident Evil were sporadic. The first I can remember was renting Resident Evil 2 for the Nintendo 64. I got as far as a hallway in the police station, and the first licker attacked me. I screamed so loud that my mother asked if I was physically injured. So
classic moment.
Yeah. And I was so scared that I didn't play it anymore after that. But once I was older and I got the GameCube, then they had the first game remade for that. And I played that many times. And then Resident Evil 4 for that system was, oh my goodness, I think I beat it 6 times maybe. I love that game so much. I ended up playing it again on the Wii, I think. And I missed
it. It was a system exclusive, wasn't it? I thought for the GameCube. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, they had a few back then, Killer 7 and Beautiful Joe, but Resident Evil 4 was the huge hit, and deservedly so. I think it's a masterpiece. And that was the first time the series went in a really heavy action direction, which we can get into. And later on, I think I played a little bit of one of the co-op ones with a buddy. But it wasn't until recently I dove back in when Switch 2 had this nice 3-pack for 7, 8, and 9. And so I've just finished those recently and had a very good time.
Yeah, the Resident Evil's having so many titles, and it's more than 9 because there's kind of like the side
and spin-offs.
Side titles, spin-offs.
Code Veronica.
I mean, I guess even Requiem is not a numbered entry, is it? Or is it numbered? I don't even know.
They end up in the credits. This is like the mildest of spoilers. They show that the Q in Requiem flips to a 9.
Ah, okay.
Oh, I was going to ask about this because I know 7, the VI is converted into Village.
That's 8.
No, is that 8? That's 8, sorry. 8 is Village. 7 was Biohazard. I think they fit the 7 into there somehow. I was wondering where 9 fits into Requiem. Okay. They pulled off those bastards.
Right, but they're kind of like, I guess you could even like say like Star Wars movies or something like that. They're like separate trilogies almost in a sense. You know, the first three are fairly consistent. They share a similar design philosophy or scope. You know, like you can bundle 0 in with there. You know, 4, 5, and 6 definitely go to another extreme, being like very kind of like Hollywood action movie style games and kind of stretching further away from its smaller, campy horror movie, low budget horror movie vibes, George Romero vibes, let's just say. And then 7, 8, 9 are their own creatures entirely. So it is interesting how there are little arcs like that. Daniel, how about yourself? Where do you come into Resident Evil?
I mean, the first time I played it was somewhere, it was Resident Evil 4. I don't remember if it was on GameCube or one of the following ports, but I similar to Phil's first experience with 2, I didn't get any further than the first chainsaw villain that chases you down and one-shots you, and like it put the game down and walked away. I mean, it also had tank controls to contend with, to be fair, so I just was not willing to put myself through that hurdle. But also have had a contentious history with horror games that I've sort of gradually ease myself back into over the last decade. So the first one I played properly would have been 7, close to when it came out, I believe. I've since played 8 and the remakes of 2 and 4, because most of those games have had pretty robust remakes, like from the ground up. At least 2 through 4 have. I don't think one had a slightly older remake. I don't think 5 and 6 have been remade, but it's quite a few options for all of these entries, essentially, at this point.
Yeah, for myself, I don't know, maybe I'm a little bit older than you guys or came in earlier, but I kind of started Resident Evil or played predominantly in the earlier entries. So 1, 2, and 3 definitely played through there, played Code Veronica on the Dreamcast, of all things. Played 0 as well. And then my sort of participation kind of drops off. I haven't beaten 4, although I played the intro mission like 3 or 4 times. Strangely enough, I've beaten 5, which is okay game, not really a solid Resident Evil entry. And then I've hardly played any of the newer ones. I played about, 3 or 4 hours of Resident Evil 7 this week, gearing up for the show. So sounds like we have a pretty wide spread of Resident Evil experience on this panel.
Yeah, I will say I've played last couple of nights, I played through the demo of 9, so I've not got the full game, but just to have a point of comparison as to where the series is going. And it is really playing quite interestingly with the contrast between the different styles, the older third-person action game and the newer first-person sort of immersive horror experience.
Yeah, so having just beaten 9, it's hard to say if it may be my favorite in the series now, but 4 was just a delight, and so it's hard to reflect that far back. So 9 is split up, right? Because in 7 they switch to first person, and in 9 half the game you're playing as Grace Ashcroft, who is this kind of nebbish agent for the FBI, and apparently I don't know how she passed field training, because she's the one who's going to get terrified, and quite well. And that's in first person. And meanwhile, the other half of the game is the classic character from 2 and 4 and maybe others, Leon Kennedy. And so he's a third person perspective and doing much more of the action bravado sequences.
It does really allow the game to have its cake and eat it too, where you can have both those versions. It's not trying to squeeze both styles of game into one. I think it did do a little bit of that in 7 and 8, where they'd start off with his much tighter sort of horror first-person experience and gradually ramp up the camp and the action. Whereas here, that they allow you to have both, but also really ramp up both ends of that spectrum as well. Like one side is really focused on the first-person horror, and one, like immediately with Leon, you literally have a chainsaw that you're taking to all the zombies and like tackling a dozen at once. And it's like quite a huge contrast, but it does allow them both to be up at 11 constantly and flip-flopping back between those two states of gameplay.
Yeah, I kind of want to nail down like what is Resident Evil at its core. And I think there's a few elements that you guys can argue with me if you want about what, makes a Resident Evil 4, but there's things that are consistent and then there's things that are varied. And I think I don't know which these categories these fall into, but they're kind of there in all Resident Evils. So one of them is camp. From early on,
it's the word that comes to mind.
Camp, yeah. Like it's horror, but it's not bone chilling, jump scare horror all around. Like I don't know, like a Slenderman game or something like that is. There's a lot of George A. Romero kind of campy, schlocky, especially with the writing in the earlier games. So that level of camp is there. There's some degree of action in every Resident Evil, some more or less. So it can be action game because there's almost always guns, sometimes rocket launchers. There's always a knife to be found nearby. So there's action. And then there's puzzles. Puzzles are also pretty central, and I think that's probably going to vary as well. But they're there from the earliest days, and they're there in the more recent ones too.
It's impossible to build a manor in this series without like filling your house with a bunch of like escape room mechanisms and keys and chess puzzles and music boxes and everything. Like everyone in this game, every engineer is obsessed with escape rooms, it seems.
That's right. And then I guess along with that is like the kind of the exploration, you know, exploration game in exploring a fairly intimately designed space, or early on it's a mansion, later on it might be a police station or something like that.
Almost a bit like a Metroidvania in some
right,
ways.
A lot like one with the locked doors and things like that. So I don't know. Am I missing some key tenets of Resident Evil there?
I think that's right. And in reflection, I think the core design problem that they have reiterated on throughout is, given the control scheme they have within the technology that's available, how do we make the enemy scary or imposing, right? So I recall, I didn't actually play the first one on PS1, but I watched my college roommate do it. And I remember in particular, there's a sequence later in the game where it had been over an hour since he had seen a typewriter, which is where you needed to save back in the day. There were save stations. And he had probably 3 bullets left in his handgun. And if he ran into a zombie, he would have to use the tank controls with no real aim to shoot it if he was cornered. And so he skated past, you know, one of the dogs just out of its range. And then in the next screen, sure enough, there was a zombie. And he plugged it once and he plugged it twice. And then it's a roll of the die in that system. That's how they made you scared, because you had a chance at getting an explosive headshot on any one of those bullets. And sure enough, his last shot he took was the headshot that blew up the zombie's skull. And we cheered, right? Just watching that together. So I think it's interesting to me how that central problem is a through line for the whole series, right? So eventually they have to change.
It's like resource management, like managing your resources as a survival horror, I guess, is one of the other key tenets of this series, and like balancing that tension. As you said, like finding your way to the next save station is a key point of like that sort of build up and release, finding the safe room and like that relief of being able to like suddenly, like it's the pressure valve to releasing, right? And I believe in those original games, the save ribbons were like an expendable resource. You could only save a certain number of times. You had to like earn the right to save.
That's right. It was a resource. It was a commodity that you had to put in your inventory system. Shout out to your intro of this episode, that you had to Tetris so many grids and block spaces in your inventory. Going back to your point though, Phil, I think you really make a good point about like the technical limitations feeding into the horror. Because the baked-in fixed camera angles were a real artifact of those earlier games. I think they switched it up in as early as Code Veronica. Or like, I was wowed when you were actually running down a corridor and you actually saw the camera pivot, even though it was at fixed key point. Walking between shots felt very, very cinematic, because the camera was placed in very specific spots for every room. There were intelligently designed blind spots that was like built right into it. So the kind of the cinematography and the game design was working in tandem, and that led to a lot of uncertainty and fear, made the survivability a lot harder. And there were even some exploits, like depending on where you were, you could stand at a certain point, press the hold down aim button, and then it would point you in the direction of the closest zombie, which you could not see. And just running between screens, right? This is, modern gamers are not going to understand this, but walking down a hall, you would switch between completely different camera angles, and then you would be suddenly running towards the camera when you were heading in a different direction before. And unless you had perfect memory, you wouldn't know where you're coming from. So the limitations added to the drama, and then it shifts totally when the game goes into, well, I guess in the intermediate sense, over-the-shoulder 3D. That was an artifact of Resident Evil 4, 5, and 6, I guess.
Yeah, that trilogy. Yeah. Basically.
And then...
But yeah, 7 really feels like that was a big reset and a big gap between those games. So that feels like they were really trying to recapture some of that tension from the early games. Like, even though you have control of the camera, because it's first person, it really does limit what you can perceive at any time. The view rates, what do they call it?
The FOV? The
view ratio, how much you can see at any moment. What you can see is extremely limited, and they can really control, like, it disempowers the player, basically, and can play some pretty scary tricks, I guess, in terms of how they're limiting information and what you can perceive at any moment.
Yeah, you nailed that point there, Phil. But I think I would say that's a through line across all the games in the series, is that those technical choices feed into the fear and the tension.
Yeah. I'm trying to imagine what it would be like on an earlier system than PlayStation 1, and I don't think you could accomplish one thing in particular, which is, except maybe on Super Nintendo, I don't know. I'm not as familiar with memory, but I think that a particularly neat thing that we take for granted about the early games is that it could store a memory of which zombie you had killed so far in the mansion and which you had not. Mm. Right. So in a typical, we mentioned Metroidvanias, right? In a typical Metroid, like, the enemies will usually reset in the room when you come back to it, unless it's a boss. Whereas in the Resident Evil mansion, if you have been through a hallway and you didn't have the ammo to fight the certain zombie and it attacked you and you barely got away, that zombie is still going to be there when you have to come back and get the key to go find, the next piece of the puzzle. So it makes the backtracking meaningful, to have to face the same threat. And they actually play with this a lot in the later games by having the enemies revive in a more powerful state, right? And so the monsters mutate and you may revisit a space and find yourself thinking, oh, I've been safe, but actually something far more threatening is here now.
Even in the earlier games, they do an interesting thing with that memory where they utilize the boarded up windows. Yes. So there was a resource where you would collect planks of wood. And I think this is definitely in 1 and 2. Don't remember so much in 3. But there would be, these windows where there'd be zombies outside and they're shaking at the windows or whatever like that. Like, so you're there, you feel a little safe. And then sometimes you'd hear a crash behind you in the hallway. And if you didn't have that plank of wood, you couldn't block it off. So they would be filtering into the spaces that you'd cleared out, and you'd be like, holy heck, I just made this place safe and now I'm not safe again. And at other key scripted moments, like this wall would get blown up because of the helicopter crash. So, the zombies would feed in that way too. So smart, but scripted ways to add the tension.
Well, speaking of scripted, that's something we were discussing earlier, Mark, that I thought we could pivot to another topic here, is that, like, playing through the demo for Requiem last night, I mean, it's a pretty scary game. I was, like, creeping through the hallways incredibly slowly. Like, part of the issue, well, part of the tension in the horror of these games is not knowing what the games are capable of, not knowing when the monster's going to jump out, and not knowing what tricks it has of its sleeve, right? As soon as you know what it is, when you know the monster's always going to jump out of this closet at this moment, you can, like, breeze through it in 5 minutes, and it becomes very predictable. So it's hard. It'd be hard for these games to maintain that sense of tension. Like, whether you're replaying the game or just dying multiple times, having to replay the same segments. I was telling Mark about a video. I think it was Germa, a streamer, had found in Layers of Fear this moment where a ghost child runs across the hallway in front of you as you step over this trigger. But if you step back and forth over this trigger, the child just keeps running out and out again, to the point that it becomes comical. And so it's horror is just really tightly wound, string that it's so easy to cut and get wrong, unless you, as I said, trying to maintain that illusion of not knowing what it's going to play with can be tricky. I think largely these games do it well, at least for the first time through, and they have been getting increasingly dynamic in how they play with those expectations, I guess.
Yes, the one thing I really, and maybe my favorite part about 9, is the level design. It, particularly in the Grace Ashcroft sections, the horror is built up in that they will lead you into a space safely and then force you, and you can see like, oh, maybe this is bad for me for some reason. And I don't want to spoil too much, but there's a room that you enter and it's like there's a basin full of water with grinding gears at one end and it's off. And it's safe to walk through on one side, but what you need is on the other side of the water and you can't swim. So it's telegraphing to you like, hey, something bad is going to happen in here and you're going to have to go back and deal with it.
It's showing the player the ticking bomb, right?
Yes.
So you have, you build out of anticipation and like, oh, you know it's coming, but rather than just a jump scare, it's letting you dwell and stew in
right.
anticipation.
And so in even more than in, I'd say actually far more than in maybe any other game in the series, I actually put 9 down multiple times as I was playing because the feeling of like, I know what I have to do next and it's scaring me right now. So
you had to mentally prepare yourself, you know, give your heart moment.
Yeah, like my heart's racing enough. I need to take a break.
Yeah, I have really struggled with these games, especially like one of the other tropes this series is playing with is the sort of the relentless enemy that can't be killed, you can only run away from. And I think in the last, you know, couple of decades, horror games have played with that to the like they've started to lean on that more for like streaming purposes. Like here's just a game to react to on Twitch and scream and be scared of, rather than trying to build an immersive experience. And so I think they do try to, like I'm thinking of games like Amnesia or Slender Man and things like that. Whereas these are more fleshed out worlds and settings that when you do have these relentless enemies, it does contextualize them a lot more, I think. So there's more to it that you can, rather than just react and be scared of it. I'm losing my train of thought here. Sorry.
Oh, you're good. Here, look, I'll riff on that. I think my favorite part of 7 is the focus on the family. Right. So you show up and there's this nasty, you know, mother and father and son who have
very Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Yeah. I think the main point of it.
And they actually end up being the three main opponents for the whole game. You hardly fight anything else until the last act. And it's very compelling. It's tied more to the story. Each one has their own particular play style that you're going to learn and deal with. And some of them recycle a little bit in some unexpected ways. So yeah, I feel like that one in particular did a good job of integrating those to the story, making them each their own unique threat. And it never felt cheap, like you're describing, like it was just a gag that you were dealing with.
Right. Connecting that back to your point about the technical limitations, it's kind of interesting to see where the series have gone. So I think they introduced the kind of roaming character fairly early on. I think it was Code Veronica definitely had one, and I think 3 also had one. It was like...
Well, 2 had Mr. X, right?
Or was that Tyrant, just the remake? I forget what their names were, but that was fairly early because I think they understood that, yes, this is like a scripted haunted house. Someone's only going to get scared by this jump scare the first time, so we have to add some sort of a dynamic element. And they were fairly rudimentary back in those generations. And I feel like Resident Evil 4, 5, and 6 was trying to introduce dynamism through numbers. So they increased the numbers of the enemies that were on screen at once. The intro part of Resident Evil 4 in that, you know, small little village area, thinking about the hordes of enemies in Resident Evil 5. So that was a kind of a technological leap. And it's interesting how they kind of go back in Resident Evil 7. That's the only one of the new trilogy I have experience with, and make it more intimate and bring it back to the small, intimate scale. And it's like a real kind of return to form for them. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. So both 8 and 9 try to have it both ways. And I think 9 pulls it off better. But 8, there's sequences where it's just you and a few threats, you know, roaming around a castle. And then that's preceded by a sequence where you're fighting a horde of werewolves, right? Because spoilers, 8 is set in a fairy tale type world.
It's very gothic horror.
And it's interesting. I think the reason I didn't find 8 as compelling gameplay wise is it's also in first person perspective. And so you have an enormous amount of control over the action. The character, unlike the character in at the start in 7 or Grace Ashcroft's character in 9, the character Ethan Winters in 8 is very powerful, has a wide ranging arsenal, and the enemies are fairly easy to line up in your crosshairs and blast away. I died only a handful of times over the course of the entire play. Whereas in 9, when you're Grace, she only has a pistol for a long time, and it fires at the rate of a slow drip of a pipe. And it's about as effective too. And then with Leon, it's like Daniel was describing, is way over the top in the other direction. But the interesting thing is that I think this is a technical edge. The enemy animations are far more random and fluid in their behavior. And so they're harder to aim at and get great shots.
They play with that bullet sway as well. Like you can't just point and shoot. You sort of that point, you're a little removed from the action of shooting. If in the reticle of your gun swaying and the zombies sort of swaying back and forth, it can be quite hard to line up a shot. You have to be patient.
Yes. And so my experience on Switch with a controller on a handheld is always going to be worse than a keyboard and mouse for that sort of thing. It was a nice challenge, right? And so I tried to develop my own strategies of aiming for the knees and then kicking them in the face and this sort of thing.
There was one moment in the demo where like you're down an enemy, but then like enemy's carrying a chainsaw, you knock them down, but then they'll still slide around the floor with like the chainsaw sort of propelling them around like a snake. And it was quite a few surprises in how the enemies move in this game.
Yes, I actually died in that very scene like 10 times before I figured out how to deal with the chainsaw because it's so erratic.
Cycling back to the puzzles a little bit of Resident Evil 7 that I played, I was remarking how far the puzzle design has failed to advance. It feels like very, very old school, even in that much later entry into the series. I haven't played it in 8 or 9, so I don't know, but it seems very much like get the object to plug it in, get the special key to open the matching symbol door. They're playing a little bit with rotating these objects in 3D to make shadow, but that's not even much of a delay in figuring out those sorts of puzzles.
It feels a little bit like those kids' toys. You know, it's the bucket with the 6 shapes on top of the star hole and the circle hole, and that you're getting the horse key and finding the horse door. You're finding the unicorn key and then going to the unicorn door and things.
Yeah, like you that. Get the handle for the crank and then whatever. It just seems like get the piece to unlock the piece. It feels very, very old school there. Do you think that aspect of these games is lacking? This is a relic of older game design? That maybe needs to be done away with? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, so it's almost a little bit of an adventure game, the way you're sort of collecting these resources too. And like the moment I played, like, you need the fuse to unlock this gate, but to get the fuse is locked up, you need a screwdriver to unlock that. But to unlock the screwdriver, you need the torch to be able to get into the dark room. And so there is a sort of adventure game puzzle of these nested.
It's Maniac Mansion,
essentially.
You know? It's just Maniac Mansion. Yeah. Like, I guess in some of them, they tried to make it a little bit more dynamic, at least storytelling wise, where you had the two partner characters. So one of them had to do this thing to unlock something for the other character. That was nice.
Hmm. Is there much of that in 9, Phil? Like the two stories that are bouncing off each other in interesting ways?
So that's a great question. The breakups in 9, the pacing is more like episodes. And sometimes you'll find out the next episode is occurring like simultaneously in time with what you just did. but it's actually unlike 4 or I think 5 and 6 maybe. There's very little, there are very few times where the two characters are directly interacting in the same gameplay. I can think of only like one sequence where that actually happens. So they're quite distinct.
I mean, it can be quite a satisfying storytelling device. Like you're playing as one character and you see an explosion off in the distance and then cut to the other character, you know, an hour later, and you get to find out what was that explosion? What was the deal with that? And sort of put the pieces together. And that could be nice in a sort of very positive
way. It is. It's very much a storytelling device and I think a pacing device too. The puzzles, I agree with you, Mark. They are rudimentary. I'm not a puzzle gamer. It's not my play preference. So it's fine for me. But I do remember 7 having the best, the one where 7 has this nice storytelling device where you find VHS tapes and they are recordings of likely past victims in this bog place that you're stuck in.
But you actually play through them as like sort of flashbacks.
So the flashback will often have some puzzle that you're exploring and then ultimately die at the end because, you know, that's how it goes. But interestingly, the puzzle usually refers to something that your main character needs to do in the actual, you know, narrative.
There's a hidden switch to the fireplace in this one spot that a character in the flashback will reveal.
But the best one I was, there's like a birthday party that's grotesquely set up. And that had a couple more intricate interactions. Not super complex, but it had something like you needed to dig out a spyglass from a nasty toilet water. And it's covered in sludge. And put two and two together that you need to clean it off by turning on, triggering the fire alarm goes off. So the water spraying down. It's like, oh, okay. So I can hold the spyglass up in the water to clear it off. So I can use it to look at it's a neat chain of events. And you end up revisiting it in the main narrative. And then in that time, you're empowered by the knowledge from this previous puzzle. And it helps you basically speed run the second go at it.
You get to feel clever.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
It's kind of a hint to that Metroidvania, that concept where you're not locked by a physical impediment. You're unblocked by knowledge. And I don't think it's truly that because you are actually gated, but
it is scripted,
do get that hint in the revelation.
It works in a narrative sense, if not a mechanical sense.
And that's also a nod to the alternate character, which many Resident Evils have. And it's interesting how you say, Phil, that 9 is episodic and it kind of alternates, it sounds like. Whereas as far back as Resident Evil 2, it's kind of like two halves to a game, isn't it? It's A, B, but you can do A or B first. And the game's not really complete until you play both sides of the record, per se. So I think interesting choices, interesting directions, and leads to interesting different kind of pacing and storytelling. All right, guys, we've covered a lot of ground on Resident Evil, and we're going pretty far. Do you guys want to like share maybe like a something you love or something that's still, you know, just gives you a smile about Resident Evil design and games, or something you absolutely hate and you wish they would get rid of? Maybe like one last idea to go around the table. Daniel, you want to give us one?
Oh, I mean, it's been a little while since I've played one of these properly, but I do really enjoy that the map layout and the way, especially I think it's since 4 or so, they've really developed this sense of looking at the maps, and it quite clearly will mark out locked doors and like whether you've cleared out a space. So navigating that map and finding like circuitous paths and like revisiting that one space, especially the quintessential element is the PlayStation from 2, really, and how you're circling this one space from multiple angles and finding shortcuts. And yeah, the real navigation exploration elements, I really like the way they fit together like a clockwork puzzle. And it's really similar to like some of the Dark Souls level design, I think, is what I've really enjoyed here.
Cool. I'm going to give one and then we'll pass it to Phil to give his last thought about Resident Evil in the series. I guess I will say that coming having played early Resident Evils and playing some of the newer ones more recently, I think that the survival, I'm coming from a different place in terms of the survival horror, is like, I felt like in the old school days, I would try and hoard as many items as possible, just like it was a JRPG or something like that, and just make myself like a tank, you know, like rerun some saves so I don't use so much ammo, so I save as many healing herbs or whatever as possible. But I feel like the newer games, I'm not sure if this is what they're doing, but maybe they're dynamically playing with the resource drops and things like that so that you feel the tension. And I feel like I'm just going with the flow and using items more, facing more dangers and just trying to play out the story more and being less of a hoarder. And I think that's a good thing in these games.
Those are great points. I want to riff on Daniel's a bit there, and actually yours too, Mark, which is I love the level design in 9. It does have that interconnected feel. There's two pieces that I mean, you got to play it to see how well the you go to one place and you find yourself underneath it. And it's a magical design. I loved the Grace Ashcroft section so much for the way they set up the horror for you and the way items were so scarce. In the later parts of the game, she never becomes super strong, but you have the opportunity to improve either her health or her power with weapons. And I chose weapons. And by the end of the game, I felt a little overtuned. I felt like I was a little too Ellen Ripley for what the game was going for. And I believe that's intended. I think they like that kind of experience. But my favorite experience in the game was when I was not sure if I was going to survive just a regular zombie. That was amazing.
Make zombies deadly again, I guess. Yeah. I mean, yeah, one of my favorite experiences in zombies games is I'm blanking on the name. The zombie parkour one. There was a survival mode in that where a single zombie is suddenly really deadly, and navigating each individual one becomes this real puzzle. And like that is so fascinating. In an era where you're just mowing them down with a Gatling gun, in so many games these days, the magic is gone, right? Like they've been de-empowered as a horror force. So much media now.
That's really cool. I feel like Resident Evil, from everything we're saying, sounds like it still has something. It's still you know, speaking to a modern audience and bringing new things while respecting some of the past. I haven't played 8 or 9, but I'm excited to try out 9 from everything you're describing, Phil.
I am reminded that we recently played another game very reminiscent of Resident Evil. That was Crow Country. Phil, are you at all familiar with that one?
No, I'm sorry, I'm not.
It only came out a couple of years ago, but it's basically looks like a retro PS1 game. I guess very similar to the first Resident Evil, but very much a nostalgic play. It's going to be very familiar to that, but it's all set in like this haunted theme park. It's very, very cool.
I feel like it's a bit more of a puzzle game. Like it's kind of like more Resident Evil themed, than it is survival horror. I feel like it's an exploration puzzle game set in that sort of aesthetic.
Nice.
Yeah, definitely recommend checking that out if you or any other listeners are interested in that oeuvre.
Awesome. All right, guys, what do you think we wrap it up with some off-topic topics, some other non-game related things that caught your interest?
Absolutely.
All right. Daniel, you want to start us off?
Yeah, just a quick one for me. A little something that I've been enjoying this last couple of weeks is Witch Hat Atelier. So this is a manga that I've been reading. I forgot to write down the notes. I think it started around 2019, but there is also an anime that's come out quite recently. I've only watched the first episode of the anime as a point of reference, but I've read the first couple of issues of the manga. And it's basically, I mean, it's going to be a very similar, very, very familiar setting with a young girl in a world filled with magic. That magic is very much inaccessible. It's something only people born with it are able to achieve. She's just a regular sort of peasant girl, I guess, but events occur such that she is able to join the world of magic and joins this little magic school to start learning it for herself. It's obviously going to be very reminiscent of something like Harry Potter, but it does play with it, subverts some of those expectations. Rather than being the chosen one, here it's like an ordinary person who happens to be capable of it. It's sort of, I don't know, I'm figuring out what the tone of this setting is, where basically the magic users are sort of regulating the use of magic, and they set up this narrative where only special people born with magic can use it, but secretly everyone can. And it's like this police force that's regulating its use, and so the normies can't find out about it. So I'm not sure where it's going to ultimately fall, but it is cool to see some at least subversion of that chosen one narrative that you see in so many of these stories. But also, magic in this world is actually, the actual mechanics of it are all with like drawing symbols. There's all these runes and glyphs that they're drawing to create it. So there's a lot of physicality to how magic is performed in this world. So that's quite cool. There's a lot of like, it almost feels a little bit like is it Wuxia? The sort of the kung fu films where they're sort of flying through the air. There's a lot of flowing robes and levitating and jumping around in some really very physical ways. I've only seen a little bit of the anime, but definitely doubling down on that. So I'm enjoying it. It's very not kid friendly, but it's very like low stakes. It's a little cozy, shall we say. Like the main character is a young girl, very wide eyes, open excitement. It's not like a super gritty story by any means. It's like a lot of heightened emotions and tropes from you will see a lot of manga and anime, I guess. But yeah, I'm enjoying it so far. Fun little mystery and evolving in there.
Yeah, Phil, are you familiar with Witch Hat Atelier or manga like this?
Not at all. That sounds really fun.
I have read the first four volumes of Witch Hat, and it's great. It's beautiful to look at. It's a really fascinating world, like you say, Daniel. It will appeal to people that maybe previously in the past enjoyed that Harry Potter kind of witching school vibe, but it plays by different rules and it circumvents a lot of preconceptions. Like, it has a concept, like a theory craft for the magic. So people that are, you know, maybe TTRPG fans, fantasy fans, will appreciate this for how its unique twist on magic. And also, it's very much about, like, there's a strong sense of, I don't know if feminism would be the right word, but these girls, they're all young girls who are the powerful magic users, except for the one teacher. And he kind of takes a backstage role. Like, he doesn't really didactically lay things out. He kind of lets the girls discover things for themselves. And at one point there, the four of them, the students, are kind of stuck against a really imposing foe. I think it's a large dragon. And they don't know what to do. Like, it's an accident. And they come together and they use their wits and they save themselves. So that's really, really nice to see. As you know, a parent of young female presenting kids, it's just, you know, really, really cool to see. So fascinating, interesting, and kind of heartwarming in a lot of ways.
It does a good job of like setting up little, like the way they solve some of these problems will be these like some throwaway line earlier in the story suddenly reminds them of something and gets them to think outside of the box in a way that feels quite organic. I think it doesn't feel forced. So yeah, nice little magic school story.
Cool. All right, I'm going to go and then we'll let you, Phil, cover your off-topic item. Mine is a TV show. It's called The Residence, and this is a kind of comedic murder mystery set in the White House. You can watch it on Netflix, and it's from Shondaland Productions. Have either of you guys seen this show?
Nope.
No, I haven't watched Netflix in a while. We don't have that right now. But I did really want to watch this as a fan of Uzo Aduba, who I know from Orange is the New Black.
Yeah, she's an outstanding performer. Her character, Cordelia Cupp, is very, very charming. This is a very large cast of great actors and character actors. So Aduba, like you said, leads the cast, flanked by Giancarlo Esposito, who you may be familiar with from Far Cry 6 or The Mandalorian. And Special Agent Edwin Park is played by Randall Park. From The Office and and from WandaVision and things like that. So he's great. But this one is fun because it's a comedy. It's a murder mystery comedy set in the White House. So the stakes are very high and the verisimilitude is very high. They've obviously researched a lot about White House procedure, politics, just kind of the pomp and circumstance of being around the White House. The murder takes place during a state dinner with the Australian government. So Daniel, you might find that
shenanigans again.
Exactly.
Kylie, trust those guys.
Yeah, Kylie Minogue makes a guest appearance, and so does Hugh Jackman, except it's not played by him, but the character is there. This show is, like a lot of murder mysteries, is fun because it's, you know, self-contained. It only ran for one season, but at the end of season one, you'll get the reveal. It'll be satisfying. And I feel like there's a lot of twists and turns, but they're kind of really like earned. And this show goes in a lot of different directions. At some point, you feel like it's a drama. At some point, you feel like it's a comedy. A lot of times, it feels like a comedy. And then this is a really touching kind of like office romance in secret is the bulk of one of the 8 or 10 episodes. So I thought that this was a kind of real showcase of excellent cast, great character performers, Isaiah Whitlock Jr., Bronson Pinchot, who you may recall from 80s sitcom Perfect Strangers, and Mary Wiseman, who is an excellent character from Star Trek Discovery. It plays the executive chef here. So just really delightful. If you want something that's, if you like mystery, you like comedy, this is a great recommendation. That's The Residence on Netflix.
I mean, I've heard great things about this. It's a struggle to take joy in wacky hijinks at the White House narratives right now, shall we say, when the stakes are so high.
Yeah, you gotta, it's a fictional White House.
Yes.
Yeah. For instance, the president is gay. His first gentleman is a character in the story. You know, Cordelia Cupp is a strong, maybe a little bit autistic African American woman. The cast of characters is very diverse and fascinating. So yeah, it kind of maybe puts you, if you like that West Wing vibe, kind of puts you a little bit in that fantasy White House world. You definitely definitely takes you away from the modern day happenings in the actual White House at the moment. Let's just say. All right, Phil, what about yourself? Do you have anything that's making you smile or of interest to you, non-gaming-wise?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention a couple comic books. One, I recently got caught up on The Power Fantasy. That's written by Kieran Gillen, and the artist, I hope I don't butcher this, is Casper Weingard. And this is the premise of this is basically, what if superheroes had really gargantuan superpowers, and effectively we have to live in a Cold War setting, because if they ever fight one another, the world is going to end. And so there's only 6 of these superpowers, and there's a host of other people who have much lesser powers. And he really leans hard into that premise. It's sometimes challenging read. Each of the characters is nearly an archetype for either ethics or morals or religion. And yet, I think Gillen succeeds here. I think that it's not only a good philosophical exploration, but I was actually quite invested with these explosive characters and the huge amounts of tension that's built into their relationships with each other and the world around them. The art is gripping, and also Weingard has just got a touch for these individuals that they're bringing to life. I actually did not enjoy Gillen's last really popular work as much, which was Die. And so
I've spoken about it previously here. Yeah. I was a bit mixing that too.
Yeah. And so that one I feel like was a little bit more, to my mind, was a little too close to that kind of world building of characters. Like we're throwing in Lovecraft showed up at some point and H.G. Wells, and it felt
like Tolkien was in there.
Yeah. And it didn't feel as earned within the narrative so much as like a playground. And here I think he forces himself to dwell in what he's built, and the implications are really tremendous to think about. So it's worth a visit. And the other one briefly is that my 12-year-old daughter recommended a comic she enjoyed, Wallace the Brave. And these are really sweet. I'd recommend them for anyone middle grade to adult. And it's originally a webcomic, I believe. The creator is Will Henry. And I think he's located not too far from you, maybe in the Pacific Northwest. But that's the setting. There's a family that's on a fishing island, and it's very reminiscent of Calvin and Hobbes. not quite as fantastical. There's no Hobbes-like character, but it has the same type of humor where the kids are they're kids, so they don't have adult intelligence, but they're acting at the top of their intelligence, as we would say in improv. And so everything they do is very logical to them. And there's lots of great comedy to come out of that. And the interesting departure, I think, from Calvin is that the parents are funny too. There's a lot of yes and going on within that relationship. And so I've found it a delight. I've just finished the first little book that has been released. I'm looking forward to more.
Excellent. I've been, my daughter has been like just devouring graphic novels right now. And there's so many that she's picked up. And I think, I think I want to read that too. Like there's some really incredible artwork and writing out there right now in kids comics.
They've really stepped up the game. You know, like I was just, my kids are getting older, so they're starting to get rid of some of their younger kid books. And we live in a housing co-op, so there's lots of youngins kicking around, and we're starting to get rid of some really like great books. Like there's like the Narwhal series, and there's the Elephant and Piggy, mm-hmm. Mo Willems, and you know, not really deep stuff, but really good writing, like really good comedy writing in there. Not to mention just that, but graphic novels like. They're these new Babysitter's Club ones are really sharp and kind of good, providing good role models and recontextualizing some topics for younger people. So yeah, we're in a kind of renaissance for young kids books and graphic novel series.
Yeah. As
it's great.
I used to write, I wrote a couple novels before I got into game design. I tried to get one published and never landed an agent. And as it turns out, most of the readers in the world are now very young, and hardly anyone around our age reads anymore. And so a lot of the work that's available for talented writers is down in the middle grades and younger. And so a lot of the creativity is being poured into those books, and it shows.
Yeah, ironic, especially after, you know, young adult novels. It's not so ironic, or had such a big splash, but there's so many of these mega series and book talks and things like that. You think people would be reading more than ever, but now we're in the post-literate age. So I don't know, maybe the young ones can bring us back to an age of readers.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Phil, for joining us. Why don't you let everyone know where we can find you?
Cheers. Thank you so much for having me. If you'd like to give me a follow on Blue Sky, my handle there is mrgross.bsky.social. That's pretty much the only social media I hang out on anymore. God bless anyone who's still on the other ones.
I feel that. Yeah. Well, you can find me also on Blue Sky at Board Game Feast and the Omni Gamers Club account there as well.
All right, so we will share a link for The Monolith, which is on Kickstarter right now, and there'll be a few days left for when this episode airs for you to check out and definitely back that campaign. Phil, are there any other projects that you want to shout out for, things that are interesting you right now?
Oh, cheers. On the horizon, I am trying to put on my hat as a publisher. The company's name is Feral Neighbor, and I'm going to be doing a small zine that a local friend, Jess Gerber, designed. It's called Billionaire Dog Party, and it is an outrageous and silly story game that I recommend for late at night or at a convention with around 10 of your friends, and oh boy, it's going to blow your mind.
We'll definitely look out for that. And did you say that that's forthcoming? It's in the future?
That's right. So if you want to check, I think we can put a link in the notes maybe, but my website, Feral Neighbor, if you want to sign up, I'll let you know when crowdfunding comes around.
Well, it's incredibly inspiring seeing all this, a lot of experimental form factors in the gaming sphere right now. Maybe that'll be the one of the intros to the podcast sometime.
If anyone here happens to be coming to PAX Unplugged in the fall, I know we'll have an indie game market, and they've already announced the, I think, 25 different designers who will have their own games there for sale. I participated in that last year with my friend Jono, who helps run DVC Games. We had a small game called Medusa's Garden, and it's just a really great community and culture that's springing up. It's a real treat to see, and I'm just very excited to spend more money on these wonderful creators. It's it's going to be hard not to let my wallet go flying.
Yeah. I got to the first indie market a few years ago, and I'm so sad to be missing them since. It's like, again, incredibly inspiring seeing some of these new opportunities for games that don't fit into these neat, predictable boxes of what games can be, and really, you know, broadening the horizon there. So yeah, very exciting. I know there's another similar one happened this last weekend that PAX West is another Pacific Northwest game market doing something very similar as well.
Well, Phil, I want to thank you again. This is a fascinating discussion, and definitely join us anytime in the future that you want to promote anything. Remind us when your new projects happen, and we'll definitely let our listeners know.
Thank you, Mark. This is a real treat. Appreciate you guys.
Awesome. So for those out there, we still put our episodes up on YouTube, so you can check us out there, of course, and you can catch our earlier back catalog of audio-only podcasts on a podcatcher of your choosing. Daniel told you earlier where you can get our episodes, and please definitely tell a friend, send us feedback wherever you can. We do this for the love. We don't make any money, so your feedback and engagement would be much appreciated. And for everyone out there, thanks, and have a balanced diet of games. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.